Reality Talk from the BBC with Kate Monaghan and Simon Minty.
Isms, Simon.
Isms.
Do you like an ism?
I guess I do. It depends.
Well, we've got a lot of them on the show, so I'm hoping you do. We're going to be talking about devoteeism, capitalism, ableism, disableism, Marxism.
Ah, this is impressive. A list of isms.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. But we're going to be unpicking some of them today, which I think is important, because hopefully it will stop your head from spinning and my head from exploding. And we've got three people who we hope are going to be able to help us out with doing just that.
I'm looking forward to this. First up, we've got Emily Yates, and Emily is 24. She's well on her way to an illustrious career in the media. When she's not giving public facilities a tick or a cross for accessibility, she's writing travel blogs, which I'm so annoyed. She writes for Lonely Planet on accessibility.
Best job.
It is. It's my dream job.
How did she get that?
She also is presenting documentaries, and her latest one is going to be going out on BBC Three on Wednesday, the 9th of March. It's called Meet the Devotees. We're going to play a snippet in a moment. Just to give you a little heads up, most of this show will have some adult themes in it all the way through. And Emily, who is in Rio, we're just trying to patch through with her, so we'll be joining her for in a minute. But here's the clip.
I really wish I didn't feel the way that I do.
There's a secret world out there, an underground world of people who are turned on by disability.
You're beautiful. I love seeing your feet and your legs. I thought they were very sexy and nice.
These people are everywhere and can be anyone.
The internet's made it a lot easier for us to be able to come together as a community.
I'm going to find out for myself whether this is something we should be accepting or scared of.
It's objectifying who I am.
I felt a lot of guilt about the feelings that I have.
It's time to meet the devotees.
Devotees. I mean, that made it sound a bit scary.
Had you come across this before, Kate?
I'd heard of the concept, but never really understood it or looked into it properly.
Yes, I've been like on my popular convention, Short People, and sometimes people have turned up to that and we've not always been sure what their motives are. I mean, to try and define it, though, it is basically someone who has an attraction or a sexual interest in someone because of their impairment, their physical impairment.
Yes, specifically because of their impairment, and they're turned on by the impairment, be it a stump or
yeah, it's kind of got to be
wheelchair.
Visible. Yeah. None of your hidden ones.
No, it has to be something you can see. Well, we'll be coming back to that in a minute.
Looking forward to it.
Yep. But in the studio with us right now, we've got Roddy Slorach. How am I saying that, Roddy?
Wonderfully well. Thank you very much.
You say it for me as well, Slorach.
Roddy Slorach.
Awesome. I do love a good accent. Anyway, Roddy is the author of a book called A Very Capitalist Condition, A History and Politics of Disability, which we're going to go into properly in a minute. But Roddy, is this your first book?
It is indeed.
And how do you price it, bearing in mind the nature? It's around Marxism and so on. How do you fix the price? Or what?
I had nothing to do with fixing the price, I can assure
oh,
you.
Man,
absolutely
you,
nothing
so
to do with it.
You have to play along with the system for now. But okay,
yes,
got
indeed.
You. We also have over in Washington, D.C., very international today, we have disability advocate, dancer and Outs Talk semi-regular guest, Lawrence Carter-Long. Hi there, Lawrence.
Hey, good morning. How's it going?
Now, your day job is public affairs specialist for the National Council on Disability, although today you're going to be speaking in your own capacity. And you're advising the president on policies and issues of disability. Have you have you met Obama? Are you looking forward to meeting Trump?
We've shook hands before, the president and I. Donald Trump, I'll plead the fifth on that one. And just for the record, I want to let people know that my favorite Marxist is Groucho.
Nice.
The old ones are the best, as they say.
And I think we've now got Emily down the line from Rio. Hi, Emily.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
We're doing well. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well.
Excellent. What's the weather like in Rio?
Beautiful, extremely hot. Mm. It's getting up to 40 degrees at the moment.
Okay, let's move quickly on.
Well, now, what are you doing? What are you doing in Rio, Emily?
I'm out creating an accessible travel guide to Rio to the 2016 Games for Lonely Planet as part of their Travel for All initiative.
Wow.
So Kate and I want to help you. How do we get involved in this?
just grab a flight over. Any help would be very much appreciated. Thank you.
You have a dream job. I think that's fantastic. Well, let's turn to Roddy first. There seems there's two key parts to your book from its title, that the disability and capitalism are linked in some way. Can we start with sort of basic 101? What is meant by capitalism? We hear it a lot, but it's not always necessarily well defined. So how would you sort of sum it up?
Okay, I would say that it's a society based on the production of commodities for exchange and competition, where people's labour is priced and valued, and people are therefore categorised according to their ability to work, if you like, in order to make profits.
And it's distinct from Marxism.
I think my starting point is somewhat different. What I would say is that what's distinctive about the Marxist attitude, if you like, to human beings and disability as well, is that human beings are characterised by the way that they create themselves and the world around them through labour, if you like, right? And therefore, when you're talking about the way in which disabled people live in our present society, then a lot of that has to do with the way that they are categorised and treated as a burden, treated as people who are not productive compared to their fellow human beings, and therefore relegated, marginalised and segregated in society in all sorts of different ways as a consequence of that.
And I know when I work with big companies, and there's this slightly awkward bit, so I can see what you're saying, where we say, look, you make reasonable adjustments for someone with a disability working for you. But there is also an implication by that, that if you don't make adjustments, will that person be slightly less productive? But obviously, say, once you put the adjustments in. But we need a law to make that change rather than companies just necessarily doing it as a good thing. Whereas perhaps Marxism companies will just do this as a matter of course, making adjustments.
Well, this is, I think you've got to the heart of the problem very quickly there, because the nature of disability discrimination legislation is precisely that. Reasonable adjustments are, in America, reasonable accommodation, which means that there's always a qualification on whether adjustments or accommodations are going to be made in respect to disabled people in the workplace or for or by service providers.
So taking your utopia, do you think we could have a world, or is your book sort of explaining a world where there wouldn't be discrimination against disabled people?
I think what my books are really arguing is that capitalist society offers the potential for everybody to have everything they need, but it's never going to meet that because it's based on, you know, generating profits for a small minority of people, where the vast majority of people who make these profits, who, if you like, are robbed of their labour, of the products of their labour,
don't get
access to that wealth.
We get paid a salary. It's not quite robbed, is it? That's like quite a strong word.
Well, I think, no, I would argue that the exploitation is at the heart of capitalism, absolutely. In other words, that people do a certain amount of work, and that work does not equate with how the value of that work. The value of that work makes profits for the capitalist, and that's the basis upon which society is driven.
Mm-hmm. Can I throw this to Lawrence? Because, Lawrence, you're in the heart of one of the biggest capitalist countries in the world, I guess. What do you think about what Roddy's saying here?
Well, I think there's a lot of merit to it. I mean, the question is who's providing the labor and who's benefiting the most from that labor. I think that's the question that we need to really think about. There's the monetary benefit, and then there's also the cultural benefit. So if we're looking at something, Simon brought up reasonable accommodations earlier, accessibility, general accessibility, right? If you step back a little bit and get some perspective on it, we know that if you make something accessible and inclusive, everybody benefits. It's not just disabled people who benefit. I mean, it's as simple as something like curb cuts, which benefit not only wheelchair users, but they make life easier for people pushing around baby strollers or luggage carts or hoping to sell pretzels from the street corner, you know, there in New York City. Text messaging, you know, which was developed primarily for deaf people, and now who doesn't text? I think that capitalism can drive innovation, but at the end of the day, who's benefiting the most from that innovation is a very important question, especially when you look at situations now where somebody can buy an Iron Man suit for $50,000, which would allow a paraplegic or a quadriplegic to stand up, yet they're not asking the question, the cost-benefit analysis of how many curb cuts could you do with that? How many wheelchair ramps could you do with the cost of that one exoskeleton?
But isn't capitalism sometimes a good thing? Like, hasn't it helped in some ways by funding things like prosthetics? And wouldn't we get into a situation where no further development would happen if we didn't have a capitalist
culture? Therein lies the irony, because as I'm sure Lawrence knows, the first mass market for prosthetics came from the American Civil War, where 60,000 people had their limbs cut off as a result of the injuries they received in that war. Most of them unfortunately died because it was before anaesthetics and so on. But actually the thing about it is that the prosthetics market has largely been driven by warfare, and that's where the vast majority of innovations came, particularly after the American Civil War, the First World War, which I talk about in my book.
you brought me beautifully on, because there is quite a little historical context, which was great. I remember reading something, it might have been in an interview rather than the book, and you were talking about the first disability movement. Was it in Russia?
Yes, indeed. It came from the Russian Revolution, and there were lots and lots of ideas that came out of that, which very few of us know much about, but and really it's been lost in the mists of time, unfortunately, because it was a very brief moment, if you like, before the revolution was really destroyed.
How did it start, do you know?
The first organisations of disabled people that were run and controlled by disabled people and funded and supported by the state were, to the best of my knowledge, because, you know, there's loads that we don't know about these issues, but to the best of our knowledge, I think, was in the Russian Revolution, and they were invented specifically for disabled people to be able to say what their needs were, and for the state to be able to resource these needs and identify support and that could be put in place to make sure they were met.
There are parallels here in the United States with that as well. The primary first rise in disability rights in the States was right after World War I, when you had people that had been veterans that were now civilians who were not included in the work administration. And with the irony there is that it was from Franklin Roosevelt. So when they were providing jobs for people, disabled veterans were not included in that, and they occupied the Veterans Administration and did one of the first sit-in in the United States back in 1935, because they weren't getting the same opportunities that their non-disabled peers were getting.
I didn't know about that before I wrote the book, I have to say, and I found it absolutely amazing. In New York, of course, you had the Bonus Army, which lots of disabled veterans were involved with as well, which got smashed to bits by the National Guard and the American government. The Bonus Army was an organisation of disabled war veterans who were demanding the payment of a bonus which was previously promised to them by the American government, which was withdrawn and which was a subject of great controversy. So they set up a camp in Washington, D.C., in order to draw attention to their demands, and that was forcibly removed by the army, and people were killed in the process and so on. And eventually, after a great deal more controversy and campaigning, Franklin D. Roosevelt, who had actually opposed the payment of the bonus, ended up having to pay it.
Do you know anything about that, Lawrence?
I don't know anything about the Bonus Army, which means I've got to get the book and educate myself. I'm looking forward to reading it. You know, it's interesting you talk about the Civil War here in the States. There was a corps of soldiers. Day Mohammed is doing a film on this, a documentary film on what was called, believe it or not, the Invalid Corps. The Invalid Corps were basically the disabled veterans who were still under active duty, who were basically watching the forts while the rest of the soldiers were still out fighting, and who held off the Confederacy here in D.C. and basically kept the city from being under siege during the last days of the Civil War, which is a fascinating part of U.S. history that hasn't been talked about much.
Digging a little bit, Roddy, and that part of the reading before the show, you were saying the social model is a sort of foundation. Can that be separated? I guess what I'm trying to say is the social model, does that have to be then built into some sort of political philosophy? Is it more naturally aligned with Marxism? Can it be just a standalone? Because, I mean, we're using the social model within capitalism.
Well, what I'm saying is that I think that the social model of disability is an excellent starting point as a way of understanding that disabled people have got rights which are not being met by society, and that the main problem isn't people's impairments. You know, it's not because people don't have legs or arms or can't see or hear very well that they're unemployed or that they're in the worst jobs or the crappiest housing and so on. That doesn't explain it at all. What my book tries to do is to tease out both the distinction and the links between impairment on the one hand and disability, in terms of discrimination, that is, on the other, because I don't think that's understood anywhere near as well as it is in relation to other, you know, equality strands or forms of oppression, whichever language you would like to use. And that's really what the book tries to start from. It tries to explore the nature of disability, a distinct nature of disability discrimination, if you like.
Is there a country that you can think of that is adopting social model, some Marxist principles, that is almost a kind of a model of what you say might work? It may not be perfect, we know that, but...
Well, I think that you have to be careful when you talk about the social model and Marxism in such a close way, because I think the truth is that if you look at the Prime Minister's website, for example, you'll find reference to the social model in an approving manner. So in many respects, the social model of disability has become very mainstream. But in many respects, it's been stripped of its substance So that a lot of the time we talk about barriers really amounting to individual attitudes rather than to do with structural difficulties, structural lack of involvement of disabled people or whatever. You know, because what we are from the Disability Discrimination Act of 1995, we're now in 2016 and we still have 50% of disabled people of working age unemployed.
But where's getting it right then? Where should we be looking to say, you're doing it, you know, this is where we should be aiming for?
Well, I think it was the development of the welfare state, both in America and in Britain, although obviously I prefer our welfare state. I hope Lawrence doesn't mind me saying that.
You can come back in, Lawrence.
Because I think that the recognition that services needed to be provided to people on the basis of need rather than on the basis of their ability to pay, which was a fundamental breakthrough in terms of disabled people starting to become more included in society.
So are we getting it right?
I beg your pardon?
Are we getting it right then? Are we the leaders? Are we the trailblazers?
We're beginning to get it right in some respects with the foundation of the National Health Service and the welfare state. But I think that, as we all know, these things are very rapidly being undermined and dismantled. And so therefore, I think that there's a big link between the need to, you know, campaign around the question of providing things on the basis of what people's needs are rather than on the basis of their ability to pay.
Lawrence, do you look at anywhere and think they're getting it right?
Completely right. I don't know that there's any place like that that does exist. I think there are places that get it more right. You know, if you look at the Dutch or what's happening in terms of benefits and what people get and receive there, what they earn based on what people pay with their taxes. But then you also get the flip side of that same coin, where assisted suicide is rampant. So So I don't think there's any system that is absolutely perfect, no matter where you are.
Because they've got a massive personal budget system in Holland, that's what you're talking about.
That's
there,
right.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Roddy, I have this sort of pet theory, and I've noticed.
Oh, Simon's pet theories. Here we go again.
Is this a new section?
This is a new section.
Okay, this would be great.
Yeah.
In the UK since 2010, we switched from a Labour to a coalition to begin with, but it was a switch. And up until that point, the mood music was around employment, about access. It has changed. I think now the most things I read around disability are more likely to be around welfare cuts, assisted suicide, perhaps some broader things. Is that a big political thing, or is that the... I'm muddling this, making it the longest question in the world, isn't it? I suppose my point being that it does affect some disabled people hugely. There's some more mildly disabled people that may not affect. I'm trying to work out why we get more and more disabled people covered, but less and less are being public about it.
OK, I think that this goes back to the government's well-worn phrase, targeting benefits at those most in need. And of course, what it's meant is getting rid of benefits for the vast majority of people that actually need them. Because if you look at what happened with disability living allowance, 600,000 people suddenly lost entitlement to a benefit they were previously entirely legally entitled to, mm-hmm. with the invention of the personal independence payment, which shifted the goalposts in such a way that it enormously tightened the eligibility criteria for benefits. And that's quite apart from all the other benefits cuts that have been taking place and the others that have been reformed away and so on. So I think that what's happening is that benefit is being reduced down to the barest minimum available for those who have the severest impairments.
But you're doing exactly what I'm saying. Bearing in mind, well, I don't know how many people get PIP or DLA, and it's a few million, but there's 12 million people who we believe could be, you know, have an impairment. Where's the stuff about employment and about the different stuff, rather than the don't take away what I've got, rather than give me more, let me get out there?
I think they seem to be flip sides of the same coin. On one hand, you've got who's contributing to society, you know, who is out there making their way in the world, and then the flip side of that coin is who's a scrounger, right? Who is living off the dole? Either way you look at it, I think the implication is that who's of benefit to society? Who is pulling themselves up by their bootstraps? Who is contributing something that is worthwhile? Either way you look at that question, it boils down to the same thing.
But the other thing is, of course, that the playing field is not at all level, because when it comes to a situation where 50% of disabled people of working age are unemployed, is that down to individual bad attitudes? You know, is that to be sorted out by GPs, surgeries, having employment advisors inside them? Is it about putting psychologists inside job centres in order to sort out the bad attitudes of the people that are claiming benefits? In other words, you know, it's a completely and utterly lose-lose situation for most disabled people, and the problem is that's not improving, it's getting worse. It's almost like saying that the problem with disability is disabled people rather than the structural difficulties that face disabled people trying to get a life and trying to make their way inside society.
Were there any parts of disabled history that really kind of that you didn't know about or that stood out to you while you were researching this book?
Yes, lots. Lots and lots and lots. The stuff about ancient Greece and ancient Rome, it was really amazing researching that, because that's due to some recent books that have come out, certainly not due to any act of genius in my part.
Can you give us a flavour?
What's that about?
Well, the stuff about the idea that all disabled babies used to get thrown off the cliffs at Sparta, right? And that's a sort of popular myth that even Hitler refers to in Mein Kampf, for example, as a justification for why his society should be just as cruel and a lot crueler to disabled people, on the basis that they were burdens and so on and weren't needed in society. Actually, that's largely untrue on the basis of the research that I can see. And there really wasn't a concept of disability at all in these societies. And then you look through feudal society or societies where, in other words, people were making a living off the land. Most of the time, these societies included disabled people. They were living much looser, extended networks of people where everybody could have some kind of role and were much more flexible, in other words, in terms of including disabled people or people at that time who had impairments. The concept of disability, my argument is, arrives a lot later with the industrialisation in particular.
Well, my head is totally spinning from all of this. How about yours?
Yes, I do. I'm not even professing to understand it all, but I could do another hour because I've got so many questions.
Well, you're listening to the Ouch podcast with me, Kate Monaghan, and him, Simon Minty. If you want to get involved in the conversation, then please do. You can email us ouch@bbc.co.uk. And of course, we're on Facebook, BBC Ouch, as well. Now, Lawrence Carter-Long.
Hello.
You've been up to something new on social media, haven't you, by starting the hashtag #SayTheWord.
Yeah, I'm always up to something. But
It's true. But the language around what disabled people should call themselves and how other people should refer to us always raises hackles. So, Lawrence, can you tell me what hashtag #SayTheWord is all about, and why have you started the language debate again?
I started it, it's never ended, right? But I wanted to put a focal point on it, because during the presidential campaigns, and again, a reminder that I'm speaking in my own capacity here, all of the candidates will make it a point to talk about every identity group that you can think of, right? So they'll talk about the LGBT community, Latinos, women, aging, even the president, who took great pains to make the State of the Union address back in January as accessible as humanly possible to everybody in terms of the streaming on the internet, the kinds of accommodations that were provided. He did his list of groups, and at the end of it, the disabled community was not included.
Wow.
And I sat there and I thought, now, to go through all this effort to make it accessible, why weren't we thought about as a constituency, as an identity group, as somebody that somebody had to cater to? And it seemed clear to me that all those fears, all those reservations sort of rise up again, and it keeps us from organizing, from coming together, from being recognized. And I wondered, started to unpack what that was about. I think we can get into the cyclical debate where either we're called, you know, disabled people or persons with disabilities. I really don't care if it's person first, prefix first. It doesn't matter to me. I think what we've got to do is get the word disabled or disability in there somewhere. And until we start flexing our muscles and say it ourselves, nobody else is going to. Look, I'm 48, soon to be 49. You know, in my lifetime, I've been called handicapped. I've been called differently abled. I've been called special, handicapable. I mean, all sorts of ridiculous
things. Which one's your favorite, then, of all the things?
Special needs are reserved for my girlfriend. The rest of them, I think we've got to keep it simple. Also, I didn't get involved in disability work until I was 35 years old because I didn't see the need. The Americans with Disabilities Act had been passed, and I thought, okay, they did that bit. we can go on, right? It wasn't until I got older and sort of had developed a skill set and got into my own life where I realized, oh, wait a minute, I can't sit on the sidelines anymore. The law might be passed, but the fight is still going on. So I was 35 years old until I found disability community. Other people shouldn't have to wait that long.
Your point about Obama missing it out, I'm like you. I've watched any political person, or even like the debate they had with the Oscars about diversity. I just want to see disability pop
mentioned
in there at some
yeah,
point.
Even, yeah, it's
and
crazy.
I don't think I'm allowed to say it, but the BBC are pretty good at it. I do see them mention it a bit more often. So, but is this the nature of, or Roddy's alluded to it, the difference of disability discrimination as distinct from other groups? Are non-disabled people a bit hesitant about engaging with it, or is it a different discrimination?
I think a big bit of the reason we're not having the conversation is because non-disabled people don't know what the hell to call us. I think until we decide, they're not going to know what to say. I also think there's that mistaken notion that, to go back to being a word nerd for just a moment, the prefix dis is a synonym for un or not. And so as long as people think, you know, being disabled means that you're not able, who's going to identify? You know, when you're in third grade and the teacher says, what do you want to be when you grow up? Nobody says, I don't want to be able, right? There's this presumption that it goes across the board that if you say you're disabled, that means you can't do any damn thing.
And do you think that Obama didn't include disabled people because he just didn't know how to say it and thought, for the sake of not offending people, because I don't know whether to say people with disability community, disabled community, is that really why he didn't do
it? Oh, I don't think it was that conscious. I think it's so subconscious that the resistance is so great that you don't think about it. You know, there's that presumption you wouldn't want to be part of that. People fear becoming disabled. But I think we can use that word, we can use the prefix to sort of explode it a little bit. The prefix can mean opposite of, right? But it can also free us from limited ideas of what ability is.
But if we put the people first, so if we say persons of disability, aren't we sort of blowing that away?
Because... But we didn't do that. I think that's a really important distinction. You know, we say person with a disability, but that turns it into the linguistic equivalent of a suitcase. Person of disability didn't even get a tryout.
Why? Why is it a suitcase?
Well, because it's something you can add on. You can take it or leave it, right? You can say, oh, I am a person, but I'm not my disability. That's what I hear all the time. I don't hear you are a person and a disability. I mean, we wouldn't say, for example, see the person, not the gender. We wouldn't say that today because anybody would say that that's absolutely ridiculous, that you've got to see both. And yet you still see memes on the internet today that say, see the person, not the disability. What's the inference there? The inference there is that disability is bad. It's something to be cut out. It's something to be cured. It's something to be minimized, diminished, and set aside. And as long as we adopt that stuff ourselves, we're never going to claim disability. We're never going to use disability. We're never going to come together with other disabled people in order to change those structural things that are out there.
I'm going to, Emily.
You've been sitting there very well behaved, Emily. Thank you so much for waiting.
You're well behaved now, but once we start talking about your show, now you're relatively younger. I mean, there's the next generation. Are we just faffing around with the same old stuff?
I'm 24, but I feel like what Lawrence is saying is really, really important and really valuable, and I can relate a lot to it. I think, you know, a lot of us really agree with exactly what he said, but I think it's really important to take that down to a grassroots level and look at average Joe in society. And actually, there's a huge fear factor surrounding disability. So it is really important that it's put out there, and it's put out there with kindness and with openness, because people are so scared of getting it wrong. They are so scared of patronising.
So what are you, Emily? Are you a disabled person or a person with a disability?
I'm either. To be honest, I don't really care. I've got a disability. I'm in a wheelchair. You know, that's me. And it is a huge part of my identity. And
so you don't mind either way?
No, absolutely not.
So, actually, Lauren, and now you've alluded to something there, Emily. I kind of sometimes think until a disabled person is politicised, they won't identify with it. So there's a lot of people call themselves disabled people. They're aware of it. Society, we get it. Then there's a whole bundle of people that might just scrape through with a person with a disability. Do we still need to use that to bring those people in, Lawrence? Because about you're making it a kind of cohesive movement is one of my big debates, so that we have such different impairments, such different backgrounds, different upbringings, all that. Can we all identify with one thing? You're nodding as well, Roddy.
Yeah, I think that the problem is that really society reduces people to their impairments all the time, doesn't it? And any concept of, you know, individuality is always struggling, you know, to get a hearing. And I think that the other problem, of course, is that most disabled people are pretty poor. You know, they tend to be at the bottom of the pile a lot of the time. And so I think that the thing about, you know, disability as a concept, as a political concept, is absolutely vital to bring that out. I mean, the thing is that people say, my disability, I mean, you don't have a disability, you have an impairment, but you are disabled by society. And I think that is a very, very difficult thing to disentangle for people, because it's a constant barrage we get of confusing these two things and conflating these two things.
But I say my disability, and I don't want to be told off for saying my disability just because I haven't said my impairment. If I choose to say, this is my disability, surely I should be allowed to say that.
Obviously, I'm not in the position to disallow anybody to do anything. Neither do I want to be. Okay, let me put it this way. It's very clear the distinction between sexism and being a woman, right? Or homophobia and being gay or lesbian, right? It's also very clear the difference between racism and being black or Muslim or whatever, right? But I think that disability and being a disabled person, disability is a form of discrimination, and being a person with an impairment, I don't think that distinction is anywhere near as clear for the vast majority of people.
Totally, so
that's why I think
that
it's called the last civil rights movement.
Look, hang on, Emily, what did you say?
Yeah, I have to say I totally agree with that. I work with a charity called Enhance the UK, and we look at reducing the fear factor, as I said before, that surrounds disability. And one of the things that we really focus on is terminology. And we talk a lot about, we wouldn't go around using the N-word anymore because that's just not acceptable, and rightly so. You know, it's absolutely unacceptable. But we still go around saying retard. Why is that? Mm. Why is that?
Lawrence, can I just ask you? I mean, we were talking about gender. In gender politics, I mean, things are becoming much more fluid now, and people are changing pronouns, and we're having new pronouns coming into use. Like, you got Mr., Miss, Mix. There's, you
Mix.
Know,
yeah, and thank goodness for that. I think that's good. You know, I think
than his or hers.
And I think what that does, and why that is significant, is that it recognizes the variations. It recognizes the diversity within that. I think the problem is, you know, if you look at where person first language came from, and I can certainly appreciate why the heck this happened. You know, there are two schools of thought here. It either came from a organizing meeting in 1974, a group of folks with intellectual disabilities or learning disabilities called People First, who said, I'm tired of being called retarded. I'm a person first. Now, if you've been called an imbecile, if you've been called invalid, if you've been called any number of things your entire life, I could understand why you'd want to be putting the person first out there. That's absolutely agreeable. The question that I have is, what are we losing as a result? What have we lost as a result if by overemphasizing the person part, we unintentionally de-emphasize the disability part, thereby letting down or de-emphasizing the entire community? That there are a bunch of us out there, and words change, words evolve, our understanding of words evolve as time goes on. I think that's what we're seeing happen here.
Can we change words in the same way that the gender
people... Hold up.
Sorry, Simon. Okay.
But this is where...
Is this another Simon theory?
Will you quit with that? No, and I agree with you, Lawrence, in the sense of using the word disabled, and people who get all a bit faffy around it, I kind of look relax. If you understand it, it's fine. But you did say a few minutes ago that the important thing about this is other people don't know what to call us. But we're also now saying, yes, the words are going to constantly change and we're going to change it. So are we making it more difficult for the non-disabled by keep changing the terms?
Some might. I think what we need to do, though, is define the terms for ourselves and own the terms and lay out their what they mean for the non-disabled public so that they can understand it. You know, we'll get them to know that 80% of those who become disabled later in life. They aren't lucky enough to be born with it, like I was. And if they want to continue to participate, you know, to go to that restaurant that they go to every Wednesday night for the past 20 years, they better make that place accessible. You know, that's really what we need to be talking about here. And we need to fight the fear. I think we need to push back a little bit. There's this assumption that if you say you're disabled, that's all you are. Well, I'm also a Buddhist. I'm a vegan. I'm a smart aleck. I'm a, you know, a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And I've never once felt that disabled was all that I was. And I don't think we'd make those assumptions about any other group. And yet it seems the disability community has internalized that old medical model that says that's all you are. And I just don't think it's valid anymore.
Mm. Well, I'm happy being a disabled. Are you happy being a disabled?
A disabled?
Yeah, just that.
I do like it when we start messing with it. I sometimes say we are the disableds and yeah, things like that. I do when it becomes endearing, if that's...
Exactly. Yeah. I call my producer, she's a blind. I think she's all right with that. Okay.
Well, people can be called Republicans, they can be called Latinos, they can, you know, they've all got their one word, right? So why is the disabled or the disableds sort of gone by the wayside?
Indeed. So Kate's advocate is don't even just say the one word.
Yeah, just say the one
word. Impairment only.
Yeah. All good. All good to me. Anyway, thank you for that. Now, coming up at the end of today's programme.
If your spoons are running low, I won't be demanding.
That's Bug Prentice with a tune about spoons for all of us spoonies out there. And I did have to explain to you about spoon theory earlier, didn't I?
Yes, I'd heard the term before, but not really. It's not something I'd used particularly, but I get it now.
Yeah, so it's about having spoonfuls of energy and how much energy you've got to use up and things.
Yeah, I'm all out of spoons. All I've got left are carving knives.
Now for the adult bit, Simon.
Please clarify that, because once we get into the subject, this is quite an awkward, strange subject.
This is the bit where we have to put our disclaimer on saying adult themes mm-hmm. ahead. Because, Emily, you've been meeting some very interesting people recently.
I have indeed. I've been meeting devotees all over the world.
So tell us again what a devotee is then.
So a devotee is somebody who finds disability sexually arousing. They are sexually attracted to disability. They may also be attracted to people who are able-bodied, or they may find just sole attraction in disability.
So, and that's different to finding a disabled person attractive, because my wife finds me pretty hot, but I don't think she's a devotee. So what's the difference there?
So the difference is basically looking at the disabled body and either fetishising it or seeing it as a sexual preference.
Does it have to be visible? Can it be sensory? People with mental health stuff, are they devotees to that?
There are different bits. The documentary that I've been making focuses on physical impairment, shall we say, after our last conversation.
And it's important to say that you have been making a TV documentary, which is going to be on BBC Three. You haven't just been popping around the world to meet these people for your own fun.
That would be a bit odd.
So, what was it like making the documentary?
It was absolutely fascinating. That's the only way I can really describe it. I'd been kind of put into the world and I really wanted to find more, and I didn't quite realise how deep it can go, and I do now.
So how deep does it go then?
There's some pretty dark and dangerous stuff out there. Things such as the struggle fetish. I don't know if you've heard of that, but the idea that, you know, I could be coming back from the supermarket, getting my wheelchair into my car, and somebody could be getting off on the fact that I'm finding that pretty difficult, quite hard work. And it is the struggle that is the attraction.
Now,
there.
Yeah, we've got a clip that shows a bit of this, and you were... This was a point where you got quite upset, didn't you? Should we just hear the clip first before we talk about it?
Somebody said that they'd love to see me transfer from or to the bed, or from or to my wheelchair, as fewer clothes as possible, with a clear view of my feet and legs. Then they've put that some spasms would be great too. I think I'm going to struggle with that bit. I think the lack of a performance in a way is the upsetting bit, because it's not... That kind of totally takes the fun out of it for me. If it was a performance and I could look really sexy, and that might be really fun, but actually what they're asking me to do is kind of just do something that I do every day and I possibly find quite difficult, so they can get off on it.
So that was the point where you were about to make a video for devotees and you'd ask people what they wanted to see.
Yeah.
What made you feel so upset at that point?
I think the realisation more than anything that, for example, if you're watching, let's call it normal porn. I hate the word normal, but let's say that. If you are watching that, you know, a porn star could be in a schoolgirl outfit, have a threesome, and then she could go back home, have a hot chocolate in her PJs, and that be that, and that be her day's work. And I think the difference is that for devotees, their disability porn, if you like, is what disabled people do every day. That is the attraction, you know, that struggle, that hard work, that I guess the tedious activities that we have to do all the time are the ones that are really attractive. So this idea of making a video of something that is really pretty boring to me and something that I don't look forward to and I don't enjoy and it's not a performance was really quite difficult, and it was that sudden kind of realisation of that's what the attraction is.
Did you get to the bottom of where the devotees are coming from on this?
I came into this documentary kind of thinking that, okay, society tells us that disability is really undesirable, it isn't valued. I don't feel particularly sexy being a disabled woman. I feel sexy as a woman, but I don't really think my disability is that gorgeous. So that kind of was my initial opinion when I came in to this documentary. And I think there's two sides to where the devotees are coming from. I mean, I met many devotees, and I have to say that some of them were really genuine. I really understood them, and I really, really liked them. I really got on with them. And, you know, what they were saying was, why should we exclude anybody? Disabled people can be just as beautiful and are just as beautiful, if not more beautiful, than anybody who's able-bodied. Because of the way that their body works and because of the way that they look and because of the intimacy that can come with having a relationship with someone that's disabled. And I get that. I do understand that. But I think there's also a problem when you fetishise something that actually it can hamper you from having full feelings for the full package of that person.
So is there a spectrum of devotees?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one reason why I made the documentary is because I think that it would be really valuable for devotees to be out there in society a little bit more and to be understood a little bit more, because the problem with something being so hidden and so dishonest in what it is because society doesn't accept it is that it does become monstrous. And many devotees don't really know exactly where they are, where they're at with things, because they've not been given that chance. So there are different devotees. There's some people that have said to me that, okay, so they start with somebody that has a mild disability, and as they go along, they go further down the line. You know, they're going on to quadriplegics, and almost the more severe the disability, the more attractive
quit,
it is.
Quit it.
That's
yeah,
so
which is interesting.
I hate to, I mean, you've reminded me of, but I laughed twice out loud during the documentary. And
did
it was,
you?
Yeah, oh, sorry.
I don't think you're really supposed to.
Well, no,
tell me when you did. I'd be really interested.
Oh, no, another pet corner. Well, it's pet theory, sorry. And let me contextualise it. It was because obviously being exposed to disability for so long, and I've seen the stuff around devotees, it was the level, it's what you just said, where they're progressing. So there was someone who was...
I know exactly what you're going to say,
I think. Was. It was saying, I want someone who's my ideal is a W amputee, someone, but it would be great if one was below the knee and one was above the knee.
Yeah.
And you, and then there's, I think we just had it, and say, if you could throw in some spasms, that'd be great.
How
can you not laugh at the absurdity of that?
There's one woman there who talks about seeing really attractive able-bodied people on the street and that she'd find them much more attractive if they were a quadriplegic. And then she goes on to say that devoteeism is beautiful and we don't all like chocolate or vanilla ice cream, which I thought was a really interesting little analysis there.
Yeah. It just seems to me that it's a bit like the old stereotype of you're either an angel or you're a devil. You know, you're either fantastic or you're awful, or you're monstrous or you're absolutely gorgeous and virtuous and so on.
Yeah.
And therefore it's a bit reducing and objectifying people. You know, as you said, you know, porn's about objectification, isn't it? And this is about reducing people to their impairments. You're not interested in the individual as such. You're interested in whatever particular form their impairment takes, particularly if it looks like they're struggling with it.
And I think some devotees are very much interested in the person as well, but I think it's important for that distinction to be made, because you're absolutely right that the fetishism of the disability is very much focusing on the body rather than the whole package of the person. And one of the things I get asked quite regularly is, well, isn't there a beautiful thing about devoteeism, because they're loving you because of your disability rather than despite of your disability? And I understand that as well.
Yeah.
But to me personally, I don't want a because of or a despite of.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be either, in my personal opinion.
Yeah.
But Emily, did this really need to be brought into the open?
It's BBC Three, come on.
Well, I think that's down to personal interpretation, of course, but for me it's absolutely important that it's brought out into the open. I remember being a 15-year-old girl and lying in bed at night and worrying that I'd never get a boyfriend. Mm. And I know for a fact that if I'd have gone onto Facebook and a devotee would have told me how gorgeous I am and how he likes all of me and he accepts all of me, then I might have been really tempted to go there. And I am not at all saying that people shouldn't go there with a devotee. That is not what this documentary is about. But what it is about is saying these are the things that could come out of that and be brilliant, and these are the things that you need to be really aware of and could make you very vulnerable.
And have you ever been approached by someone you think might have been a devotee?
I mean, of course, all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Simon, what about you?
We revealed quite a lot last month. Am I going to do it again?
Yeah, you have. Yep.
I can think of two occasions where I think someone was interested in sleeping with me purely because I was short. And on both occasions, I turned them down because I didn't know how I'd feel afterwards. The problem is I do know how I feel. Damn it, I missed that one.
Yeah. Lawrence, how about you?
Most of my adult life, as a matter of fact. You're talking about my whole dating history.
Do you think it's important, Lawrence, that it's spoken about, in all honesty?
I think we absolutely have to speak about it, because the more that we, all jokes aside, the more that we put it underground, the more that it becomes shameful, the more that it becomes hidden, I think that you run the risk of it becoming even more scary.
Yeah.
So we hold it up to the light. We give those individuals who are devotees an opportunity to kind of scratch that itch a little bit, and the rest of us to understand it. Maybe we're all a little bit better at the end of the day. I'm curious, though, if there's a whole market out there for, developing some new productions of people writing lifts and looking for Braille menus and watching captions on their TVs, because that's pretty much the everyday life of disabled people.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, if we can corner in and cash in on that market.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's money to be made here just by having a webcam up or something.
Hold up, we just got Marxism in.
Sorry.
Look at you lot, you're now trying to explore what is going on here. Roddy,
but we're putting the money back towards society, Simon.
Fine.
It's a philanthropic venture that we're going to benefit all as a result of that creative idea.
I'm going to come back to you in a moment, Emily. But Roddy, I mean, in terms of devotee, have you had any experience of this?
I think I'm probably too much of a lightweight in the impairment field when it comes to that, to be particularly attracted. I think I've given more comments about my accent than anything else. I had to come to London
your accent
for
is
to
nice.
Find a Glaswegian accent attractive.
So you're hearing
and
loss
does it disturb you when people like you just for your accent?
Sort of, because I don't understand why people would find the Glaswegian accent attractive. But there you go. It's something about identifying as Glaswegian, perhaps, that's a problem.
You were very brave, because you did make a film, and presumably you're in a weird situation now. So when the documentary goes out, if everyone goes, watch that, and you get thousands of hits, you'll be pleased, but then you'll also think, hang on, there's a lot of devotees watching my porn now. Is this a difficult position you're in now?
I mean, that was my choice at the end of the day, and that's something that it took a lot of time for me to really think about, because, of course, being only 24 and only really starting out my career, that's something that, of course, you've got to be really aware of, that's going to be around forever. But it was really important to me to really almost get into the mind of a devotee, and that devotee video of me getting in and out of my car, we took it 3 times. And the first time, I didn't speak at all. And I almost cried again after doing that, because I felt so objectified.
Yeah.
And the last one was when I was almost doing the commentary about my tattoos and about my legs and about how much I love my car and how much independence it gives me. And because I had that slight more control, I was really happy with that and really happy with the way that it was. And also, we've got to think that, I don't have my boobs out at all. I'm not saying anything sexual. The only thing that it's doing is looking at my feet and my legs. And to anybody else who isn't a devotee,
that isn't remotely interesting, never mind arousing.
So why do you think there's so much chatter about sex and disability at the moment? I feel like everywhere I look, there's disabled people taking their clothes off around me.
I was in Edinburgh for the festival last August, and I think there were four or five shows that featured disability and sex as well.
I think there's a lot of people campaigning, as I am, for disability to be seen as something that's really valuable within the sexual world, to look at inclusive sex education in schools, because at the moment we've got young disabled women who are more than twice as likely as their able-bodied peers to be sexually abused. And one of the problems of that is the fact that we're having sex education in schools, but if you've got a hearing impairment or a visual impairment or you've got a mobility impairment and your body doesn't look like the ones on the videos that you're watching, you're coming out none the wiser about sex. So that's one of the reasons that I think is really important. Regarding people taking their clothes off and flaunting it about a little bit, I mean, in a way, why not? We have plenty of able-bodied people who are doing exactly the same thing. But I think it is important to not objectify it sexually too much.
With relation to disability, I think one of the reasons that that happens is because those tired stereotypes of disability either being tragic or heroic are largely played out. We've seen all of that before. What we haven't seen are disabled people sort of owning it. And I don't think there's any better way to own it, really, than to sort of be out there and upfront with your sexuality. That's something that hasn't been seen, that hasn't been played out, that is for, let's say, the non-disabled public, and I would even venture to say for a lot of disabled folks themselves, something that is relatively new.
And I think also, you know, we talk about all these shows in Edinburgh and things like that, but the reality of the fact is that I still go into bars now and men come up to me and they ask if I can have sex before they even say hi.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the reality of the situation, that obviously it's still something that really needs to be talked about because it's just not getting through.
I think a bit of it's part of a pushback. If that assumption is out there that disabled people are not sexual or that we can't, a natural counter-reaction to that is to say, yeah, buddy, watch. And that's kind of what's... I think that's a part of what's going on here, and that seems healthy to me.
Roddy?
Yeah. It was a poll done in The Observer, I think, 5 years ago or so, and it said 70% of people asked that they wouldn't have sex with somebody who was physically disabled. And I think that very much confirms what you're saying. Most people regard disabled people as asexual. You know, they don't have a sexual identity. It's scary. And it's very much this sort of the other, you know, about disabled people, that they can't be seen as human beings like everybody else and have desires and everything like everybody else does as well. And that seems scary for some people to look at it that way.
Well, I remember that survey too, and that 70%. I would even go as far to say, but some people are repulsed by it. It's not just a different, it's a really can't go there. But that's, we've got a smaller pond to
small
do our
pond.
Fishing.
We do, Well, I hope we've given you some food for thought on this month's talk show. Next month, we'll actually be celebrating 10 years of Ouch talk shows. Can you believe it? We're going to be trawling through the archive for some of the older stuff, but we're also going to be looking forward into what Ouch in the future might be like. So please let us know what your favourite bits from the past 10 years have been and why. Get in touch with us all the usual ways. Email us ouch@bbc.co.uk, find us on Facebook BBC Ouch, or tweet us @BBC Ouch.
Thanks go to Beth Rose, editor Damon Rose, they're not connected.
No nepotism here.
And studio, thanks for the ad lib. And studio manager Ross Saunders. The producer has been Lee Kumita.
And thanks especially to all our guests joining us today, Roddy Slorach, Lawrence Carter Long, and Emily Yates. And as promised earlier, with thanks to band member Ali Craig, here's Bug Prentice with Spoons. Goodbye.
When the rest are just confused, you be understanding. If your spoons are running low, I won't be demanding. The feeling just like home when I'm over your your place. I don't need a camera. To remember your face.